Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Beth Healy, a financial investigative reporter with the Boston Globe, who has uncovered Mitt Romney's transformative 1988 business deal, which turned a $10 million investment into a $175 million profit for him and Bain Capital. We will discuss this deal that was financed by junk bond king Michael Milken, who at the time was under an SEC investigation that led to his conviction and imprisonment, a time Romney refers to as the glorious days of Drexel Burnham, quoting him, "It was fun while it lasted." Then the author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States, Michael Lind, joins us in the studio. We will discuss America's economic history, in particular the current era we're in that began in the mid-1970s with the Great Dismantling, as Michael Lind calls it, an era where the household wealth and living standard of most Americans has stagnated or declined, while the wealthiest 1% have benefited from increased productivity, accruing most, if not all, of the additional wealth. Then finally, a Syrian-born filmmaker, Sam Cady, joins us in the studio, the director of a new feature film, The Citizen, which is about a Lebanese emigrant who comes to America just before 9/11. He recently testified before the International Criminal Court in The Hague about the ongoing slaughter of Syrian civilians by the Assad regime, atrocities which filmmakers like Sammy's murdered colleague Basil and others risk their lives to document. And joining us now is Beth Healy, a financial and investigative reporter at the Boston Globe, who rejoined the business section to do financial investigations in 2008. She spent several years with the Spotlight team, where their 2006 investigative series, Debtors' Hell, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Additionally, she won an Enterprise Award from the Society of American Business Editors and Writers in 2010. Welcome to Background Briefing, Beth Healy.
Thank you.
And you have an article at the Boston Globe, The Story Behind Romney and the Junk Bond King, deal with Michael Milken in the late 1980s, transform Bain Capital and the future candidate's business career. I find it extraordinary that one of your sources from Drexel Burnham, Michael Milken's firm, who actually did the deal with Romney back then, what, in 1988, said that Romney knew he had to make a lot of money to launch his political career. So all of this activity at Bain Capital was not just about getting rich, but it was about becoming president?
Well, I think everybody knew that he was a very ambitious man, and they didn't know for sure that he wanted to be president, but it was certainly a possibility given his father, and people knew that he had certain ambitions beyond making money, I guess.
Well, but does it mean in a way that you, I'm trying to get the correlation between making hundreds of millions of dollars and becoming the president of the United States. Is that a prerequisite? I mean, I guess we had somebody out here in California ran for a U.S. Senate, spent a couple hundred million dollars of her own money. But it's an odd thing that you would, that these things are being tied together in our current environment. But I guess it kind of makes sense with record amounts of money being spent on politics.
Yeah, of course, you didn't used to need this much money to be president, right? but he did spend millions out of his own pocket in the past when he ran for governor and for Senate.
So, Beth Healy, what was it that surprised you about this? Because Michael Milken, of course, is well known out here in Los Angeles, where he's based, and he made a considerable fortune and left a number of bankrupt widows and orphans in his wake, and then spent 22 months in jail, paid $650 million in fines, come away with a considerable amount of money because he's formed a lot of charitable foundations and think tanks, etc.
That's right. He has remade himself since prison and the downfall of Drexel.
So tell me about this deal then. This was just to set the stage. The environment is the early 80s, and we're told that Mitt Romney was a relatively cautious investor. It was in his fifth year in Bain Capital, but he decided to take a really high wire risk.
That's right. So it's 1988, 1987 when they first started working on this deal. This is a time when LBOs, leveraged buyouts, are becoming much more common. It's the high-flying 80s, and Bain was only a few years old as a firm then, and Romney was known as a very cautious guy. The firm had only done a handful of deals at that point, And then there's this opportunity to put together a couple of department stores down in Houston and create this company called Stage Stores. And basically, there was one guy that you went to in the late 80s when you needed junk bonds, when you were doing a risky enough deal that you couldn't just go anywhere on Wall Street. You needed the guys who could do a little bit riskier bonds. And so even though Drexel was under scrutiny by federal regulators by that point, Romney and Bain went ahead and raised $300 million. They put down $10 million of their own money and investors' money and borrowed the rest for this $300 million deal, and it was their biggest deal yet.
Well, but Romney and Bain managed to turn a $10 million investment into a $175 million profit.
That's right. It was huge. It was far and away their biggest deal. And this was really what turned Mitt Romney from the idea of kind of dabbling in venture capital and doing smaller deals and startups to saying, hey, wait a minute, the big money's over here in leverage buyouts.
So little wonder that in a little noticed interview that you dug up, Beth Healy, from the American Banker magazine, Romney said that he was working with Rexall Burnham in their glory days, saying it was fun while it lasted.
Well,
I should say it was also profitable while it lasted. But what happened to these stores? I mean, they put this deal together and then managed it for a while, and then they went public, and then some of the shareholders sued in 1999, saying that investors, including Bain, had inflated the company's stock. And then by 2000, the company has closed 60 stores, and then later in that year, they filed for bankruptcy protection with $444 million in long-term debt and had to close 300 stores and, what, lay off 5,000 workers. So walk us through this arc of the deal from which he profited and the collapse of this company, which eventually then reemerged well after he was long gone.
So the deal went well for quite a while. They put together Palais Royal and Beals, these kind of old line, small department stores, put them together, and the company was profitable and was doing quite well for a while. But then comes 1997, and Bain's getting ready to exit. They usually like to stay in companies for about 3 to 5 years, and this was getting to be about 9 years. And they'd taken a few tries to go public. They finally managed. The stock was doing very well. So June of 1997, Bain's still on the board. They agree for the company to do yet another deal that nearly doubles the size of the company. This is a big deal. But just a few months later, they were ready to go and had sold all their stock, cashed in, made a $175 million profit, and they were off the board. So in the succeeding 3 years after Bain got off the board, things went seriously awry. And, you know, what Bain would tell you is that they had nothing to do with what strategically went wrong when they were gone. However, they were there when the decision was made to expand so aggressively. And indeed, things did go wrong under the CEO those next few years. And they ended up having to, as you said, lay off thousands of people, close 300 stores. And the company did emerge from bankruptcy, but it was obviously a very bad time for a while there.
So specifically, Romney's doing a deal with Milken. Milken's before a federal judge, Milton Pollack, and by coincidence, the judge's wife, Moselle Pollack, is the chairwoman of Palais Royal, which is one of the companies that the department stores that Bain had bought and merged to create this, what was it called, Stage Stores or something?
Stage Stores, that's right.
Right. That's an extraordinary coincidence, isn't it?
It was pretty extraordinary. In fact, there was a rumor around at the time that perhaps Drexel had actually courted Bain to do this deal in order to create this kind of conflict of interest and sort of derail the case and get the judge taken off. But other people said that was not true, that you know, Drexel was not aware of the conflict before.
But the point here is that this is a window into a kind of methodology. It's not that Romney and Bain were the only people that were doing leverage buyouts, but it really, of course, is at the heart of this campaign, in as much as candidate Romney is running on the idea that he's the businessman who can fix America, fix a broken America, like fixing broken companies. But the record is, in terms of the deals that he made, in many cases, they fixed them for themselves. From a $10 million investment, they made $175 million profit, left the company saddled with a lot of debt, and eventually, in this case, they went into bankruptcy and fired 5,000 people. So I take it that this is a window into something that's going to be contested in this election between what Romney can claim and what the Obama administration can claim in terms of competing narratives about the value of leveraged buyouts.
Well, in particular, when Romney presents himself, as he often does on the campaign trail, as being a turnaround guy, as having been an investor who really got his hands dirty at companies and understanding how companies run. And that is very much what he's using to say that he could help fix the economy. But as with Drexel, he really was more the financier. He really was not the day-to-day person on the ground working on these companies, but he was someone who could make a connection to Drexel and, you know, on a handshake, get a deal done and do this very big, risky financial deal that ended up creating huge profits for Bain and for their investors.
So, again, I'm speaking with Beth Healy, a financial investigative reporter with the Boston Globe, and she has an article at the Boston Globe written with Michael Cranish, who, along with his co-author Scott Hellman, wrote The Real Romney. I've actually interviewed Scott when the book came out. Beth, you contributed to that book as well, right, as well as co-writing this article now at the Boston Globe, The Story Behind Romney and the Junk Bond King.
I did. I worked with Michael on the Bain Capital chapter.
So this period that Romney refers to, the glorious days of Drexel, and it being fun while it lasted. At the same time, the Securities and Exchange Commission were looking into Michael Milken, and eventually he did 22 months in jail and paid a $650 million fine. So, you know, I'm almost tempted to ask the old Watergate question in terms of Mitt Romney. What did he know and when did he know it?
I don't think that Romney knew you know, in particular about what Milken had done wrong, and, you know, the firm was under investigation for...
But he did know it was under investigation, right?
He did. He knew it was under investigation. Everybody did know at that time. And, in fact, there was a little problem that rose up at one point because the judge in the matter that the SEC was pressing with the firm, his wife, the judge's wife, was the chairman of one of the department stores in this deal. And so there was a whole issue about Drexel trying to get the judge thrown off the case. Ultimately, that did not happen, and it didn't end up mattering because the firm pled guilty. But there was really a moment here when there was quite a bit of anxiety at Bain, and they were saying, oh my gosh, what have we got ourselves in the middle of here? But they went forward with it.
Well, but it sounds like, just in terms of what happens when you are a company that's been taken over by a leveraged buyer, where they see value, they enhance value, extract the value for themselves. I mean, it's a new form of capitalism, at least a different form of capitalism, and it's very much what seems to be going on in Wall Street, you know, where we have a capitalism based upon the extraction of wealth rather than the creation of wealth. So how much wealth did he create for himself vis-a-vis how much wealth did he create for these companies? Because so many of them seem to have not survived.
Well, of about, you know, 100 companies that he worked on when he was at Bain or that Bain invested in while he was there, Bain made most of their money, the vast amount of the money, on sort of the top 10 and 20 deals. And something like 10 of them went bankrupt, and about a third of them, you know, didn't make money or else something else happened along the way to the company. But, you know, these firms, they make most of their money on sort of the top 20% of the deals. And I think it really does say something about what was going on in Romney's career that there was this point where they realized that by taking less risk, but by borrowing more money, they were able to do these giant deals And you absolutely can argue the point you're making. Did it do anything good for the companies, or was it only good for the investors? In some cases, Bain's type of investing has, in fact, grown companies, has added employees. In other cases, it was just a kind of financial engineering, and parts of companies got cut, shut down, people lost work.
But you have to add to that that this deal was done with a guy who was under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission, who eventually went to jail. And there were a lot of victims of Michael Milken. And, you know, and he paid a $650 million fine, but still somehow managed to have millions left over to become a new kind of charitable entrepreneur, if you will.
I mean, perhaps it shows how irresistible in a way it was to get pulled into this type of financing in the late 80s, because Bain hadn't done this particular type of junk bond deal until Tilstage Stores deal came along. And then all of a sudden, it just kind of set them off on their road of doing leverage buyouts, because they saw how incredibly successful it could be for them.
So, Beth Healy, one of the sources that you spoke with for your story with Michael Cranish in the Boston Globe, the story behind Romney and the junk bond king, this fellow, Mark Wolpow, who actually did the deal with Bain at Drexel, he says in your article that Mitt spent his life balanced between fear and greed.
Yes, he did say that. You know, I think Mark actually admires Romney. Mark is also, in full disclosure, a Democrat, mm-hmm. Although I think he may be supporting Mitt this time. I think Mark really saw this deal from both sides. He saw it from being, working at Drexel, and then he ended up joining Bain and kind of bringing that sort of knowledge, that Wall Street aspect to this firm that was really mostly kind of consultants and Harvard MBA types before Mark got there.
But given that Mark Wolpow also said that Romney had his eye on a political career and he wanted to make money in order to, I guess, finance his own political career, he was definitely taking a risk there, reputational risk, working with a company that was being investigated by the SEC.
He was. Romney would say that, in his mind, Milken hadn't been convicted yet, and therefore, why not do business with a guy who, so far hadn't been convicted of any crime? But it apparently upset the SEC, because it did kind of cause this whole problem in the case by having allowing Drexel the opportunity to claim that there was a conflict problem with the judge.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in closing, Beth Healy, obviously the story is going to become a part of the competing television hit jobs that the Romney campaign are doing and the Obama campaign is doing. And we live in a period in America which many consider to be the new Gilded Age. The disparity in wealth is great and growing at record levels. Do you think that there is some traction here in the subconscious of America? And one of the great ironies, of course, is that Tea Party was born out of the outrage of what happened in 2008. But I've never felt that the Democrats have ever established a really good narrative on really explaining this extractive form of capitalism as opposed to the traditional notion of capitalism, which is where you create wealth, you don't extract it for a few privileged individuals.
For sure, people are going to be evaluating Romney in this way, because he is presenting himself as the candidate who can fix the economy and fix the country by being able to fix the economy. And so what we tried to do was look at his business record. And so we've examined many of his deals. And this deal in particular we thought was interesting, just because it showed a moment of ambition, a moment of pivoting from sort of relative caution to embracing this high finance of the era. And it was when Romney really saw how much money Bain could make on a deal.
Well, Beth Healy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Beth Healy, as a financial investigative reporter at the Boston Globe, who rejoined the business section to do financial investigations in 2008. She spent several years with the Spotlight team, where their 2006 investigative series, Debtor's Hell, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Additionally, she won an Enterprise Award from the Society of American Business Editors and Writers in 2010. She has an article at the Boston Globe, along with Michael Cranish, the co-author of The Real Romney, The Story Behind Romney and the Junk Bond King. We're going to take a brief station break and be back, joined in the studio by Michael Lind, the author of Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thanks.
So your book, Michael Lind, deals with these two threads in both American political and economic history, the Jeffersonian and the Hamiltonian, and Jefferson, of course, being against bigness and wanting to have small independent businessmen and farmers and other producers, Hamilton believing in large, powerful institutions and powerful organizations. And one of the great ironies, of course, is that the Republicans who today claim Jefferson and the Democrats today claim Hamilton, it's not entirely clear, because on the Jeffersonian line, you've got the Democrat Andrew Jackson, the leaders of the Confederacy, William Jennings Bryan, who ran against McKinley, Louis Brandeis, Barry Goldwater, and Ronald Reagan. And on the Hamiltonian line, which is now the Democratic Party, you've got George Washington, Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln, William McKinley, and both Roosevelts, and Dwight Eisenhower. So how do you navigate through all of those contradictions?
Well, it's a matter of some tension sometimes. The Democrats have an annual Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner to celebrate the founding of their party. And I asked the late Democratic senator from New York, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, what did they celebrate on Jefferson-Jackson Day, states' rights and the expulsion of the Cherokee to Oklahoma. He laughed. But it actually gets it's kind of serious in a way. When he began his administration, Bill Clinton, or may have been during the campaign in 1992, Bill Clinton made a pilgrimage to Monticello, the home of Jefferson, the nominal founder of the Democratic Party. In 1998, he had me as a guest to the White House after I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that the Democrats should be the Hamiltonian Party. And at that point, he agreed with me. Of course, politicians can agree with whoever they're talking to. So what's essentially happened is, I argue, that there's been continuity in these two traditions in the U.S. The parties have switched constituencies. Or names, if you want to put it that way, since the Civil Rights Revolution, when the white working class and the white South left for the Republicans, the moderate Rockefeller Republicans in the North have migrated en masse into the Democratic Party now. But if you don't look at...
Or been driven out of the Republican.
Or been driven out. They were fleeing. No. But if you don't look at the party labels, you look at the regions and the traditions, there is this what I call the Hamiltonian tradition of developmental capitalism. It sees the government, business, and in its more progressive versions, labor, as partners in a common project of economic nation building. And that has always been based in the Northeast and in the Midwest. and this rival Jeffersonian tradition. I think the Jacksonian tradition is just kind of a more raw-edged, more brutal version of Jeffersonianism. And that's always been based in the South, the tradition of states' rights, hostility to bigness. What I point out is neither tradition is necessarily pro-market. It's not libertarianism of the Ayn Rand or the Austrian school. Both the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians have always been in favor of government intervention in the economy for particular goals. The goal of the Hamiltonians is to modernize the economy as quickly as possible using advanced technology. The goal of the Jeffersonians has been a political and social goal. It's to preserve a majority of small producers, be they small farmers, small shopkeepers, small bankers. And in pursuit of that goal, the Jeffersonians have always favored fairly drastic interventions in the economy against bigger organizations, ranging from antitrust to anti-branch banking laws, which were very important for many generations in the U.S., punishing large banks, and so on.
And of course, the book points out that America's economic history has been a series of revolutions and counter-revolutions, with each revolution tied to a war, Revolutionary War, Civil War, and World War II.
Well, I argue that there have been three republics. Even though we pretend we're still under the original Constitution of 1788, in fact, we do rebuild the country now and then, and it tends to be in these periods of crisis. And so the Second Republic was founded by Lincoln and his successors after the First Republic broke down during the Civil War and Reconstruction. Franklin Roosevelt and his successors, including Republicans like Eisenhower and Nixon, who shared many of his premises, was built between the 1930s and the 1950s and 60s. I think we're living in the dying phases of the Third Republic that began with Roosevelt, and most of the second half of its history, beginning not just with Ronald Reagan, but also with Jimmy Carter, who was much more conservative than people remember, has been kind of a neo-Jeffersonian backlash against this earlier Hamiltonian nation-building period of Roosevelt through Nixon.
And that's the period that you call, the period we're in now, the Great Dismantling.
Yes, that's right. And it's quite clear in hindsight that the technology, economics, the recovery of Japan and West Germany, the stagnation of the world economy in the 70s, all of those things required a renovation of these New Deal era institutions that had been adopted for the quite different circumstances of the 1930s and 40s. What we got instead was this, to my mind, utopian belief that we don't need to modify regulations, we just need to get rid of them all, and the market will take care of all of this. And it's often forgotten, democratic economists like Charles Schulz, Alfred Kahn, who presided over the dismantling of airline regulation, these were Democrats. It wasn't simply Republicans who had this newfound faith in laissez-faire, which most of an older generation of conservatives had lost.
Right, but the most enduring and the most influential of the economists, of course, was Alan Greenspan, the former executor of Ayn Rand's
That's
will,
right.
And a total devotee of Ayn Rand, who then became, under Reagan, the head of the Fed. And, of course, basically, in many ways, people argue he ran the Clinton economy.
But it's more a kind of a worldview. And the Chicago School of Milton Friedman is really a fundamental, influencing a lot of so-called neoliberal Democrats. Like Larry Summers and Robert Rubin, as well as conservative Republicans. So there was kind of a bipartisan consensus, which included modern Republicans like Eisenhower and Nixon during the New Deal era. It was succeeded in the 70s and 80s by a new consensus, which lasts to this day. A high-ranking former Obama administration official told me one time, we don't believe in regulation. We believe in transparency and market incentives. Right. So this is still very much that 1980s, 1990s mindset. I had thought it would have been shaken up more by the greatest global depression since the 30s. But so far, you still have the established consensus on both sides of the Atlantic. Not only is in place, but it's leading to potentially suicidal policies like austerity in Europe and the cutting back of state and local spending in the U.S., which has neutralized what good effects the federal stimulus might have done.
Now, that when the Great Dismantling began, it's concurrent, that's the mid-70s, under Carter, but it was also the time for the famous Powell memo that was a response to the anti-Vietnam War and the hippies and peace, love, and dropping out and all that stuff. And it's sort of interesting in a way that some of the most powerful people in this country are those that rejected and were appalled by the free love of the 60s, the John Robertses, the Sam Alitos on the court, and the presidential candidate on the Republican side, Mitt Romney, who was deeply appalled by what happened. So the reaction has a face, but it seems to me that, that the idea of the Powell memo was the big business in this country has to wake up and get involved in politics, because we need, otherwise we're going to have, a whole generation of anti-capitalists.
That was one of a number of initiatives taken by the business elite to essentially end its 20-year truce or so with organized labor, going back to the Treaty of Detroit, so-called, in the early 1950s, where the big three auto companies negotiated with the labor unions. And then this kind of set an example for the rest of corporate America to treat unions as a part of the landscape that's legitimate in the way in much of Western Europe they're still considered, rather than simply enemies to be wiped out, which had been the view until then. I think when you look at these individuals, you have to ask, well, why did this particular thing happen at that particular time? Because there had been reactionaries, you know, writing memos about going after the unions in 1945 and 55 and 65, and nothing happened.
Right. Colonel McCormick.
So I think the context that changed was the slowdown of economic growth throughout the entire industrialized world. It's never been adequately explained by economists, although I think the best explanation among several is that the second industrial revolution based on automobiles as the central industry had not only until you got the computer revolution in the 90s when you start putting more and more IT into cars. By the 1960s and 70s, the earlier Henry Ford paradigm of automobile technology, you'd pretty much rung all of the changes that you could do on that. And at the same time, you have Japan and West Germany, and in the case of Japan, very aggressive state promotion of exports, flooding the markets. So I think that that kind of structural surplus and the gluts that were driving down growth, it was even more important than some of the other factors like the oil crises around the same time in creating this climate of stagnation in which ideas that would have seemed too kooky and right-wing radical fringe 10 or 20 years before suddenly got a polite hearing.
But since this period that we're talking about, what you describe, Michael Lind, in your book, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States, The Great Dismantling, we have seen the gradual takeover of our politics and our economy by an American elite, an oligarchy, if you will. And there's just been endless evidence about the disparity in wealth growing and growing and growing. There's Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision in many ways accelerated into the current political environment where a handful of billionaires, the 0.1% of the 1%, appear to be buying the next election. And this has led to this backlash movement, the 99% versus the 1%. The question is, has this, I mean, and in fact, you can argue that the elite is running a member of the 1% as their candidate. So what explains this the corporatization and the, I don't know what the word for an oligarchization of America, what explains the inexorable growth of it and the fact that in spite of the economic elite taking the global economy to the brink of collapse in 2008, they're back stronger than ever?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the perception of threat that is felt by the privileged elites. The last time in history where there was really no significant external great power threat in the decades following the Civil War, the Confederacy had been put down, the Mormons had been crushed, and the railroad strikers were pretty much suppressed with federal aid in the 1870s and 1880s. That's when you had the Gilded Age, right? I think there was a genuine establishment in the United States from World War II all the way up until the 70s. It wasn't because these were more virtuous people or they were less greedy or anything. It's just they were more frightened. They remembered Huey Long, the demagogue. they remembered the pitched battles between goons and company goons and labor organizers in the 30s. And they were really, really scared by what they had seen happen in Weimar Germany and in Russia and so on. And so there was this sense that there was a minimum amount of solidarity that was necessary. And there were also restraints on partisanship among the elite, if just for purely Machiavellian reasons, right? You couldn't just slaughter each other.
Well, I remember William F. Buckley and his best friend George McGovern had these very civilized debates on firing line on PBS.
Well, in my earlier neoconservative youth, I spent a week in Gstaad, Switzerland, vacationing with Bill Buckley and his then best friend, John Kenneth Galbraith. This really was a different world, right, than the world of Rush Limbaugh and, you know, whoever the equivalent on the left
would be. Take no prisoners.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sorry to say, I think that we're still in that situation. And globalization has strengthened the hand, obviously, of investors and managers, because in the old days you could shut down the factory in Maine and move it to South Carolina and move it to China or anywhere in the world.
Right. They've used globalization as an excuse for cutting loose their fellow citizens.
Yeah. And in the case of the Great Recession, which I expected to have more of an effect on shaking things up than it has done, and in thinking about why that has not been the case, I've concluded it was the success of the New Deal, particularly of unemployment insurance, which eliminated soup lines and the visible evidence of suffering. And so the elite, in which, you know, circles I move and you do as well, and in many cases, I'm sure, really has no idea how bad things are, because you don't see people in lines on the street, right? You don't see the torchlight parades. So it's sort of a pessimistic vision. In the absence of a perceived internal threat and or an external threat, the incumbent elites of any societies, not just the United States, they don't have much of a motive in order to undertake reform. To the extent that I'm optimistic, it's because I'm pessimistic. I think we're at the beginning of what someone like E.H. Carr in retrospect will call the 20 years crisis or the 30 years crisis or something. That is, you know, when I see references to the recovery, this reminds me of 1931 when everyone thought the Depression was almost over, and then Credit Anstalt fails in Austria and brings down Germany. And so we're talking about the German and Central European economy today.
Right.
Which
George Soros says, I think a day ago he said they've got 3 days left before.
Well, you know, I don't want to sound like one of those crazy people asking you to send money for a newsletter about, you know, the coming crash and you have
right.
to become a survivalist. But I, Reinhardt and Rogoff, these two economic historians, did a book. This time it's different, about financial crashes. And they said it usually takes 5 to 7 years to recover, and this has become sort of the standard line. They were talking about individual countries or individual regions like Asia in the 1990s,
right.
where there were other parts of the world acting as locomotives of growth. Right now, if you look around the horizon, where is the engine of growth? It's not here. It's not East Asia. It's not the developing countries. It's not Europe. In fact, what we found out from after the crash in 2008, people had been talking before that about decoupling. That is the idea that the world economy now was sufficiently vigorous, and particularly developing countries, that they no longer needed the American market to drive it. Turned out to be completely wrong. It turns out that American consumers borrowing in order to afford what they couldn't afford with wages had been buying goods in China, many of whose ingredients, as in the case of the iPhone, actually came from other industrial countries like Japan and West Germany and South Korea, and which consumed raw materials from developing countries like Brazil. So the entire Ponzi scheme was actually centered on the debt-strat American consumer. And until wages are raised in other parts of the world, or there's some alternate form of public investment to get demand going, I think we're looking at a very, very slow recovery, if you can even call it a recovery at all.
And, of course, the political consequences of this are very bizarre, because my suspicion is that Romney may well be the next president. And if you see what happened in Wisconsin, the ability to spend unlimited amounts of money and get people, just barrage them into sort of submission, it's almost a sort of political version of the Stockholm syndrome. And there is no representation or no articulation of defending the American dream, defending the middle class, and restoring the America that you've written about before the great dismantling.
Well, this is not surprising if you look at the history of depressions. We've essentially had three depressions since the Industrial Revolution began. You don't have depressions before you have mass production industry, because you don't get mismatches between supply and demand in a village blacksmith economy. So the first Great Depression was the Long Depression of the 1870s through 1890s. Then you get the second depression in the 1930s. This is really a third global depression, even though we call it a recession. What happened in those previous two in most countries was that forces of the authoritarian, nationalist, populist right came to power. And there is a certain perverse logic to this. That is, when it turns out that either the economy is shrinking or it's not growing as rapidly as you anticipated, people are less generous. In every group in society, the rich, the middle class, the people who have votes and influence, they scramble to save what they have by forcing the other groups that are less politically organized in order to swallow the losses for all of this wealth that has just disappeared. And you find the same thing among nations with trade wars and rival currency devaluations and all of that. So again, I don't want to, you know, encourage people to go buy gold and, you know, stock up on firearms or anything.
Cans of tuna and live in the bush, right.
But we're, you know, it's the, as Churchill said in the early years of World War II, it's the end of the beginning. It's not the beginning of the end. But I am confident that what will emerge from this period, which I think will go on, you know, maybe a decade or two, it will be as different in the United States and in Europe and Asia as the world of the 1950s was from the world of the 1920s. This is a period of really major change for the first time in a long time.
Well, just in closing, Michael Lynn, without characterizing what kind of change we have ahead of us, do you think, I mean, first of all, there's an appalling lack of education, which I think is an element in why people will vote against their interests. Not that anybody's giving them a good narrative of what their interests are. But at the end of the day, it seems to me that tied in with this pervasive ignorance is jingoism and we're the greatest country on earth and all of this kind of stuff. And yet, you know, even Exxon's running commercials saying that we're not. But on the other hand, you could make the argument that even though we're not as good as we say we are, we still could be better.
Well, if you look at the previous reinventions of the American Republic, at great cost in blood and treasure and suffering, in crises like the Civil War and the New Deal, which involved violent labor battles, among other things, and then it was followed by World War II, when the smoke clears, the system is still corrupt and jingoistic, but it's better than it was before. You know, slavery has been abolished. You know, you have a 40-hour work week. So the country does advance, I think, over the long run, two steps forward, one step back. I think we've been taking one step back from the last advance in the last 30 or 40 years. But I am an optimist enough, having titled my book Land of Promise. I've quoted Churchill before, so I'll quote him again in a different context. He said, the Americans can be counted on to do the right thing when they have exhausted the alternatives. And I hope he's right.
Thank you very much for joining us here, Michael.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined in the studio by a Syrian filmmaker.
Come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
We've all seen enough now, it's time to decide. The meekness of love or the power of pride. It doesn't matter if you're good or smart. God.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Sam Caddy, who's the director and filmmaker of The Citizen, a feature-length film just out about a Lebanese immigrant who wins the U.S. green card lottery and comes to New York City the day before 9/11. Sam Caddy was born and raised in Syria, and has completed 6 short films, documentaries, and promotional films, including Schizophrenia and the award-winning Raised Alone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Caddy.
Thanks for having me.
And Sam, you just recently, a little over a week ago, testified before the International Criminal Court in The Hague and talked about, showed footage and talked about your friend Basil, who was, as you said, neither a terrorist nor a member of Al-Qaeda or an armed gang, but in fact was a Syrian Christian filmmaker who was killed by the regime trying to document what the regime is doing to Syria's own people, to the Syrian citizens.
Absolutely. I mean, I had the privilege to be at The Hague, and I was recognized by Cinema for Peace Foundation for basically raising human rights issues through film, and was invited there and to speak before the ICC. And Basil, as you just mentioned his name, and with like many other artists over there, I feel artists in Syria, if I start in general, their voices have been muted. Mm-hmm. And somebody,
well, all dictatorships, exactly. The first people they go after is artists,
Exactly.
Whether it's Castro or whether it's the Stalin or Hitler or you name it.
Exactly. And I think in the case of Basil, I mean, he's an amazing person who basically dedicated his life to his profession and most importantly to his people. He left his master's degree in film studies in Syracuse University in the United States to go train activists how to document the revolution, to document, the uprising over there. And he ended up, getting murdered and getting killed. And he was shot before he actually had the opportunity to shoot the truth. Mm-hmm. On the Syrian ground. And there are many other examples. Definitely Basil, as a filmmaker, I addressed and dedicated my speech at the ICC, for Basil. But there are other examples, like the singer Kashush, who basically who was chanting these songs on the street against the regime, and they ended up basically cutting his throat and throw him, I think, in the river. The cartoonist, the Syrian cartoonist, the very well known cartoonist, Ali Farzad, they broke his fingers. He was beaten by the regime. So many examples of what's going on over there with the artist.
But what all of these people are doing and what you're trying to do is to get the footage out, the information, the truth out about what's going on, because the Assad regime have had very good public relations for 40 years. They bought off a lot of people in the West to suggest that they're actually, and in the case of the son, the accidental leader now, Bashar, that he's a reformer that was out there mm-hmm. forever. And now finally people are seeing what this regime's always been about, which is about this is their own family farm. They control the place, and you better not complain or you die. And that's how they've kept the power. How many people is it going to take to reach the point where the world has had enough?
Well, this is, I think, a great question. I asked this question myself. What's the quota? What's the number that, the international community is waiting for to satisfy their needs to basically to take an action? And if they feel right now they're applying pressure on the Assad regime, I would like to say that pressure is not enough, because nothing has changed. And actually, the brutality of the regime has increased significantly. And since Kofi Annan actually went there, there are like right now more than like 3,000 people, dead. And just to bring some facts, we're talking right now about over 15,000, Syrian murders. We're talking over 50,000 people missing and over 200,000 people in prison. And you're talking about over 1 million Syrian displaced. This is a disaster. This is a humanitarian crisis. This is beyond description, beyond belief. The slaughtering, the killing, the bombshelling, and I can go on and on.
Well, but we hear about the dead, and now the official figure is like 12,000. You're saying it's 15,000. In fact, this is what you said to the International Criminal Court. There are more than 15,000 dead, including 4,000 children, more than 100,000 people arrested, another 50,000 missing, and 1 million people displaced. Now, that's not getting much publicity. The gulags, 100,000 people that are in prison, of course, we know they get tortured. I mean,
when you say actually 100,000 people in prison, nobody even know right. if these guys are alive or not.
They've just disappeared.
They are in prison. They were documented that they went to prison. But what's happening in there? Are they still in prison? Are they still alive? Nobody knows. And right. you're so saying 15,000, 12,000? I will guarantee you it's, right. it's over 20,000.
Well, what's it going to take? I mean, now we have a situation where the Syrians apparently, we know they shot down a Turkish plane. Turkey went before the NATO. They didn't invoke Chapter 5, but in Chapter 4. And now they're going to increase their defenses on the common border they have. There was just a defection the other day of a general and a whole bunch of colonels, 200 mm-hmm. people crossed with him. They're obviously going to set up some kind of safe zone in Turkey.
Okay.
You get the feeling that even though the international community has been impotent, they haven't done anything. They don't know what to do, including the United States. Something has to be done now because the Turks are getting fed up. Everybody's getting fed up with this guy. He won't go. The Russians have even tried to get him to make a deal, and he won't make a deal.
Well, I mean, I think that the Russia and China issue, and we all know, you know, how they thwarted the efforts, you know, by the UN to basically accuse the and to stop the
right, Assad
regime.
Right, they vetoed
the yeah. But what I just said, and I said to the International Criminal Court, the international society have found so many ways in the past to bypass such an obstruction, and to move forward with what's right. So this is not the first time that, you know, it will happen. It happened before. And we got to a point where we're urging Russia not to provide the regime over there with helicopters and weapons. And the regime is against intervention. They don't want intervention. They are using the intervention. Everybody's intervening over there. I mean, what's Iran doing? What's Russia's doing? You know, I mean, the Syrian people left alone, unfortunately.
Mm. Well, it's heartbreaking, and you know, I'm always amazed at the courage of people in that have stand up to oppressive regimes like it started in Tunisia, and it spread to Egypt, and then it spread to Libya, and it spread to Syria. Syria's turned out to be one of the more brutal ones because the regime simply won't tolerate any kind of dissent.
Mm-hmm.
And to a lesser extent, you see young people, for example, in Mexico, appalled at their government and the control of the media. I know it's nothing on the scale of Syria because the regime doesn't, these other regimes don't wantonly kill their own people.
Well, actually,
but there's something going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm suggesting. There's a youthful revolution going on in the world where young people just are fed up. They want their freedom, they want their future, and they don't want to have these disgusting, corrupt despots dominating their lives and dominating the media with their fatuous promises. I mean, that's what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the massacre that happened at the Al Hola and Al Qureb that was just recently, you know, with more than 200 people. 200 people, these are two massacres that happened while, you know, the observers are there.
Mm-hmm.
These people were not killed by bombshelling, by the way. These people, they found that they were executed one by one. They were slaughtered one by one.
By the Shabia.
Yeah, Shabia. And some of them were actually executed by, a bullet to the head, and others were burned alive. So, and the observers are there. Now, the observers, they are there, but they, you know, they put everything on hold. Hmm. So you can imagine what's going on.
Well, tell me about your colleagues, and one of whom died. They're trying to get the word out. A handful of courageous journalists go in there, and there's basically no support for the Assads except from the Iranians and the Russians and the Chinese. They're ambivalent. Chavez, the Venezuelans, giving them oil. But by and large, they're increasingly isolated. And you went to the International Criminal Court to make this humanitarian appeal. It doesn't seem to be working. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary, that we've seen this before. We saw this in Bosnia. We saw this in Kosovo. People talk about the Holocaust forever. It's big, you know. But here we are witnessing it again. And what does it say about humanity and about our so-called level of civilization on this planet?
Well, honestly, it gets to a point where you start feeling ashamed of being a human being. I am afraid to say that. I mean, just watching and witnessing what's going on over there. And we've seen it. We witnessed it. And we promised ourselves that we're not going to witness another, you know, crimes against humanity to that level. But we are witnessing. And I think the world needs to move and needs to act fast because it's getting out of control. And that's going to affect, you know, the entire region. I'm not a politician myself, but, you know, we can analyze. We can see what's going on. Everything is escalating, at this point. And I demanded, like, from the International Criminal Court to at least condemn strongly and openly and to document what's going on and to put pressure, you know, on the entire, you know, international community.
Well, you're a filmmaker, and I know you're not a politician, and we should have been talking more about your film. Just in the last minute, tell us about the Citizen. Is it a comedy or a tragedy?
It is a story of an Arab immigrant who wins the U.S. green card lottery and arrives to New York City one day before 9/11. So it stars Khaled Nabawi. He's an Egyptian star, an acclaimed Egyptian star who played in Fair Game with Sean Penn, and he's actually the international voice of the Egyptian Revolution as well. He's a huge activist in the Middle East, and stars Cary Elwes from The Princess Bride, as you know, Bill Atherton from Ghostbusters, Agnes Bruckner from Blood and Chocolate and Murder by Numbers, and Rizwan Manji from Outsourced. It's a great team produced by myself and Chris Wyatt, the producer of Napoleon Dynamite, the great cult comedy, and with a great executive producer, Dr. Amir Kabur, who without him the movie would never be made, and M3K Pictures that made the movie.
Sure. But tell me though, just from the point of view of the film audience. What your setup sounds like? We gotta wrap it up here. I'm sorry to tell you that we've literally run out of time, but we'll hear more about this.
Absolutely,
and the film will be
no problem. Well, thank you so much for having me here, and looking forward hopefully to see the movie out. But it's a drama; it's not a comedy.
I see. That's what I wanted to hear from you. Okay, I've been speaking with Sam Caddy, the director and filmmaker of The Citizen, a feature-length documentary, a feature-length film out about somebody who wins the green card lottery and ends up in New York City the day before 9/11. And he's produced a number of documentaries, promotional films, including Schizophrenia and the award-winning Raised Alone. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30.